Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Wednesday, October 19, 2016. A South Sudanese economic analyst praises the latest fiscal budget released by South Sudan's Ministry of Finance.
He's hearing very well what the donors want and what the country wants. First, he says, or the leadership must ensure that peace prevails in South Sudan. This is the precondition. Without peace, you can't do anything. Number two, reforms in key areas that are also very central to implementing the budget.
And President Kiir forms a joint committee to look into obstacles preventing aid groups from reaching the needy.
This committee will be working to expedite the humanitarian access to all needy areas and also to identify the area and the impediment.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. An economic analyst with the Ebony Center for Strategic Studies is praising the Minister of Finance for allocating 15% of the country's budget to the implementation of the peace agreement. James Alich Garang says the peace agreement is key to development in the country. Michael Atit has this report for VOA from Juba.
The 2016-2017 fiscal year budget presented to Parliament by Finance and Economic Planning Minister Stephen Thiou allocates more than 11 billion South Sudanese pounds to the security sector. Thiou says he is aware of the economic challenges facing the country.
The fiscal year 2016-2017 budget has been prepared under extremely challenging circumstances under the theme to consolidate peace, unity, and economic recovery. The reshuffle of the cabinet in accordance with the peace agreement and the recent conflict has slowed the production of the national budget.
Unlike previous budgets, this year's draft was presented 3 months into the new fiscal year. Minister Thiou says he allocated 5 billion South Sudanese pounds to cover costs of the implementing the 2015 peace agreement. Thiou says he believes South Sudan's economy will not recover unless lasting peace is restored across the country.
The achievement of peace, coupled with economic reform, is the only way to return the country towards a sustainable pursuit of economic development. I hope the reform within this budget, combined with peace and expansion of international support, will lay the foundations for a recovery.
James Alich Garang, a senior economist at the Juba-based Ebony Center for Strategic Studies, says the international community pressured South Sudanese government to come up with a budget that not only supports the peace deal, but promotes economic reforms. He says Thiou got the message.
He's hearing very well what the donors want and what the country wants. First, he says, or the leadership must ensure that peace prevails in South Sudan. This is the precondition. Without peace, you can't do anything. Number two, reforms in key areas that are also very central to implementing the budget.
Thiou says in order to increase its revenue base, the government will double taxes on alcohol from 50 to 100%. He also says the government will increase taxes on cigarettes from 30 to 50%. The minister says by raising taxes on those two commodities, he expects to raise 133 million South Sudanese pounds. Garang says, the government is unable to develop the economic sector in large part because of the insecurity across the country. He says, for the past 2 years, the government has had to divert the bulk of its resources to protecting the president and other top officials.
So previously, you don't need someone to escort you from year to year. But now, you need the police, you need the army, you need somebody. Those escort cost money. They cost fuel, they cost personnel, they cost time. Or they have opportunity costs. Those army that are used to escort people would have been used in another productive sector.
Gotch Makwach, the head of the Economic Committee in the South Sudan's National Assembly, criticized Juba's over-dependence on oil export for its revenue. He says the country's leaders must look into other revenue streams.
It is better that we diversify our sources of revenue. This parliament approved about 6 months ago National Revenue Authority bill. It has been signed, it has become law, and has not yet been implemented. We are urging the minister to implement the National Revenue Authority. It will take over all the responsibility of the collecting agencies in the country.
The Economic Committee will study the 22.3 billion South Sudanese pounds budget and is expected to recommend adjustment in certain areas before presenting it for the second reading within 3 weeks' time. For VOA News, I am Michael Atit in Juba.
Still in Juba, President Salva Kiir formed a humanitarian aid committee last week to work with aid agencies trying to reach people in desperate need of help across the country. International aid agencies and the United Nations mission in South Sudan have complained that security operatives have set up too many roadblocks, hindering access to needy South Sudanese. Waki Simon Wudu reports for VOA from Nairobi.
The new committee is supposed to remove all obstacles affecting smooth delivery of life-saving assistance to millions of people affected by the ongoing conflict. Presidential spokesman Atenywek Ateny says the committee includes government ministers, United Nations officials, the military and police officials.
This committee will be working to expedite the humanitarian access to all needy areas and also to identify the area and the impediments whereby the United Nations is complaining about not being given process of leverage to deliver humanitarian aid.
Ateny says the committee wants to fulfill a promise made by the first Vice President Taban Dengai to the United Nations General Assembly in New York last month that his government will lift all obstacles hindering the delivery of aid across the country. UNMISS says security agents have repeatedly blocked its peacekeepers from conducting patrols in parts of the country where civilians were killed by unknown gunmen along various roads leading in and out of Juba, including the Juba-Yei Road. UNMISS charges that government forces also blocked its peacekeepers from accessing areas in Yei River State where clashes occurred between government and opposition forces, leaving 21 people dead. UNMISS acting spokesperson Chantal Pessoat says the United Nations welcomes the decision to form a committee and hopes it will make a difference.
The mission urges the committee to start working as soon as possible and in close cooperation with the United Nations humanitarian coordinator. The mission stands ready to support the delivery of humanitarian assistance in South Sudan, which is in line with our mandate.
The Norwegian Refugee Council is among 8 agencies that has suspended operations in some parts of South Sudan's northern states after the outbreak of recent violence. Some of its staff personnel were relocated to Juba. Country Director for the Norwegian Refugee Council in South Sudan welcomes the move by the government of South Sudan. Victor Moses says he too wants to see practical steps being taken to ensure smooth aid delivery.
We had an office in Lier, which was carrying out food security, livelihood activities, and emergency education activities. They had to be suspended. Humanitarians had to. Some of them who are not from Lier, the others from other locations, had to be brought back to Juba. And at this time of point, as I speak to you, some of the areas like Lier, the humanitarian service has not returned fully to operation.
Moses says 8 agencies and civilians still fear returning to the areas where aid services are needed due to ongoing fighting.
The biggest challenge is having access to some of the locations because there are some conflicts going on. Therefore, regular flights do not operate there. Some of the NGO's property has been destroyed, for example, in Lier and Unity. At this point, we are not yet sure of the security situation there to return and deliver services. We are also not sure whether the people who are coming to receive the services will remain safe or not. Due to this, I would wish this challenge would be effectively handled by the Humanitarian High Level Oversight Committee.
According to a report released early this month by the United Nations Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs in South Sudan, continuing fighting between government forces and rebels in the former Unity State and some areas in the northern part of the country continue to displace thousands of civilians and forcing aid workers out. For VOA News, I am Wake Simon Wudu in Nairobi.
The head of the Joint Monitoring and Evaluation Commission has condemned the continued fighting between the government and SPLA-IO forces, as well as Riek Machar's call for renewed armed resistance. Tito Justin reports for VOA from Juba.
Festus Mogae condemned the fighting between government and opposition in Yei, Ler, Jezira and Nasir, adding that NFADA violence is proof of the country's failed leadership. Mogae says he is particularly concerned about what is happening in the Equatorial region, where armed groups are targeting civilians.
There are almost daily violations of the ceasefire perpetrated by uniformed armed forces of SPLA-IG and SPLA-IO and other armed groups. The hostility, or rather this hostility, has the potential to trigger an uncontrolled escalation of violence motivated by retribution.
Mogae says the recent violence has frustrated the efforts of the transitional security arrangement mechanism, such as the Joint Military Ceasefire Commission. He says the leaders of the warring parties have an important role to play.
I call upon both sides to gain full control of their forces and observe the ceasefire with immediate effect. There can be no compromise on this issue. Leadership must be demonstrated and restraint must be shown.
Mogae criticized both warring parties for violating the rights of civilians by committing crimes such as killing, rape, looting, and the intimidation and harassment of members of civil society and the media in recent months. He urged South Sudan's leaders to investigate human rights violations and bring the perpetrators to justice.
I say again, as I have said before, that there cannot be and will never be a military solution to the conflict in South Sudan. The only path to sustainable peace is dialogue and the relentless pursuit of reconciliation and an inclusive political process.
Mogae says President Salva Kiir's government should implement all aspects of the peace agreement and observe the permanent ceasefire.
We do not make peace with our friends. We reconcile with those with whom we disagree. We urge the Tugnu to re-establish an environment within which all people of South Sudan, irrespective of their ethnicity or background, can safely return and engage in constructive and peaceful dialogue.
He criticized the warring parties for restricting the movement of ceasefire monitors who he says are being hindered from carrying out their mandate. Representatives of the government continue to say the Kiir administration is committed to implementing the outstanding issues of the permanent ceasefire and transitional security arrangement. Cabinet Minister Martin Elia Lumuro calls the agreement complicated and complex. Lumuro says the transitional government of national unity has agreed to demilitarize Juba as part of the security arrangements stipulated in the peace agreement.
On continuous violation of ceasefire, both sides agreed to control forces and reinforce orders. The two chiefs of general staff were ordered to request CITESAM and GMCC to visit and report violations on containment sites. Again, containment areas in Greater Upper Nile and Greater Equatoria have now agreed with Cabinet Resolution 21-2016 dated the 10th of June and 31-2016 dated to 24th of June and confirmed during plenary meeting of the 18th yesterday.
Despite the talk of peace and adhering to the peace deal, there are reports of fighting in parts of the country. Lomoro says, in efforts to end the violence in Greater Upper Nile region, the government has decided to create two more states in an area where, he says, people have been fighting over land.
Now we have 30 states instead of 28, and a 9-member team has been formed, led by the first vice president, to report back to the president within 7 days. These 30 states, the additional two to resolve on the Churuk Dinkapadan in Malakal area and the Raja Awil conflict in Upper Nile.
Mogae says the regional protection force remains a prerequisite for a secure, peaceful, and stable environment for political inclusion in the country. He did not say when the regional force would arrive in South Sudan. For VOA News, I am Tito Justin in Juba.
are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, we take a look at the Global Hunger Report. That report is coming up next.
For in-depth news and analysis on events in South Sudan, tune in to South Sudan in Focus, Monday through Friday from 1630 to 1700 UTC. We are also on the web at www.voanews.com/South Sudan or download our podcast on iTunes. That's South Sudan in Focus on VOA Africa.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
do you try to grow most of your own food?
I don't grow most of my own food because it is cheaper to buy than to produce your own food.
Only grow vegetables, so no, I guess. Mostly because we get some food from home, like our home village. They already have a plot there where they grow. So yeah, in a way, yes, we do grow food, most of them.
Not me personally, but at home, yeah, we grow our own food. We always have a garden behind our house.
No, I don't try because usually at home we don't have a place.
In reality, no. We just buy from the market. Though we have plenty of lands and we have the rain, but to put the hand on the ground, no one has attempted that. But in the countryside, our people used to do that.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus. The October 2016 Annual Ending Global Hunger Index, released by the Washington-based Brookings Institution, says international community is behind its goal to end rural hunger by 2013, as outlined in the United Nations Sustainable Development Goals. Ayen Bior reports from Washington.
Jeffrey Gertz, a postdoctoral fellow at the Brookings Institution, warns that global warming could increase drought and floods in the coming years, making it harder for farmers to grow crops. But Gertz says at the global level, the world produces enough food to feed everyone, and that tools and technology to end rural hunger exist.
But the real problem is that in many rural communities in developing countries, the local agricultural economies are not productive enough. And so this is a problem for a few reasons. One, it means that less food is being produced. There's not enough food for the community who depends on it. But also, lots of people in these rural communities depend on agriculture for their income. So when the agriculture is unproductive, it means there's low incomes and people don't have enough income to buy food either.
Sudan is not one of the top seven countries listed as having alarming levels of hunger. But Sudan does have at least 16 million people who live in rural poverty, and at least 24% of its population are undernourished. The report did not include figures for South Sudan. Gert says the heads of developing nations like Sudan and South Sudan must take the lead role in ending rural hunger in their respective countries.
They need to invest in their own agricultural systems and kind of put government budgets towards this goal. This is something that governments are increasingly talking about, particularly African governments, but there's still sort of a lot more that needs to be done in matching the rhetoric with actual dollars. They also need to reform their domestic policies. And this means sort of removing price distortions in agricultural markets and doing more to encourage private investment in rural areas.
At the same time, Gert says rich countries also have a responsibility in meeting the UN Sustainable Development Goals by investing more in science, research, and new technologies, and by making sure their policies are good for farmers.
A lot of rich countries, particularly kind of the U.S., Europeans, and in Japan, subsidize their agricultural markets a lot. And these subsidies distort global markets. They kind of lower global food prices, and that makes it really hard for poor farmers in developing countries to compete with these subsidized farmers in rich countries.
Gertz warns climate change is likely to produce more extreme weather in the near future. He says it's likely that the African continent in particular will see more floods and droughts, and if left unchecked, the effects of climate change could prevent the international community from reaching its goal. Ayen Bior, VOA News, Washington.
In the Democratic Republic of Congo, the streets of the capital, Kinshasa, were quiet today after the opposition called for a general strike. The main opposition coalition in DRC is protesting a deal signed earlier this week between President Joseph Kabila and a smaller opposition platform that will postpone elections by nearly 2 years and leave Kabila in office in the interim. For VOA News, William Clouds reports from Kinshasa.
On Wednesday, Kinshasa experienced a so-called Dead City Day for the third time this year. It is similar to a general strike and designed to show the population's discontent with the government. Children are supposed to stay away from school and adults from work. The main opposition coalition, the Rassemblement, called the strike to demand that President Joseph Kabila step down in December at the end of his second and under the constitution final term.
La ville morte, moi je le soutiens. C'est une ville morte pour nous.
Near the central market, a young man called Kabir Ndai says Kinshasa supports the strike because it is for them. It is because the people are unhappy with the leaders of the country. Observing the strike is a sacrifice, Ndai admits, but a patriotic sacrifice. Kinshasa's normally chaotic early morning streets were quiet and nearly empty. Shops were sealed off with steel doors and public buses operated a reduced service, carrying only a few passengers. But towards midday, VOA saw many market traders, money changers and mobile credit vendors working, and some shops were opening as well. Kinshasa is a city of more than 10 million people, the vast majority poor and only a fraction with salaried employment. Taking a day off work, therefore, could mean a day without food, or for the fortunate few with salaries, risk punishment. Several state employees said they had been instructed to work during the strike, but would not provide any further detail.
La ville morte d'aujourd'hui, nous on n'est pas satisfait que chez nous.
At work crafting baskets, carpenter Herman Abanda says the strike is a bad idea. He says for the little people in Congo, everyday life means going out and looking for something to eat. He said the country's politicians should sort out this crisis among themselves so that the little people do not suffer. Last month, street demonstrations resulted in dozens of deaths as security forces and protesters clashed. There had been fears similar problems might arise on Wednesday. In the Limite neighbourhood, an opposition stronghold, police used tear gas to disperse a group of opposition-supporting young men. But calm soon returned and the strike appears to have remained free of violence in the capital. Kabila's ruling coalition had called on the people of Kinshasa to ignore the strike, warning them a day without work is a day lost for the electoral process. William Clouse for VOA News, Kinshasa.
And here in Washington, U.S. Democratic presidential candidate Hillary Clinton and the Republican candidate Donald Trump meet in Las Vegas, Nevada this evening for their third and final presidential debate. Trump continues to trail Clinton in public opinion polls, and today's debate may be his final opportunity to change the direction of the race with less than 3 weeks to go until Election Day. VOA national correspondent Jim Malone reports from Washington.
The final debate looms is crucial for Donald Trump, who trails Hillary Clinton by an average of 6 percentage points in recent national polls. Trump continues to warn supporters they are fighting the Clinton political machine and a biased news media.
This is a rigged system, folks, but we're not going to let it happen.
Even some Republicans have rejected Trump's claim. Trump has also lashed out at allegations from numerous women who have accused him of making improper sexual advances in the past.
These are lies being pushed by the media and the Clinton campaign to try and keep their grip on our country. They are all false. They're totally invented fiction. All 100% totally and completely fabricated.
Clinton has been immersed in debate prep in recent days. Despite continuing controversy over her emails, she's tried to keep her campaign focused on the issues.
Number one, we've got to get the economy working for everyone, not just those at the top. And we can do this.
Clinton is getting help on the campaign trail from President Barack Obama and First Lady Michelle Obama, who noted Trump's vulgar comments about women in a recently released videotape.
This was a powerful individual speaking freely and openly about sexually predatory behavior.
Trump has slipped in some polls in the wake of the salacious video and the allegations from several women, says analyst Tom DeFrank.
This is not the behavior that's going to endear him to college-educated white women. That's who he needs.
Trump and Clinton likely have different approaches to the final debate, says Republican strategist John Feary.
I think Hillary is going to play it safe because I think she believes she has the lead. I think Trump is going to go for broke because he believes that he's got to make ground and really kind of attack her.
In the final weeks of the campaign, both candidates will focus on a handful of so-called swing states where the election outcome will be decided. Jim Malone, VOA News, Washington.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Here is today's top stories with South Sudan in Focus editor Carol Van Damme.
Thanks, John. An economic analyst in Juba is praising the Minister of Finance for setting aside 15% of the country's new budget to implement the peace deal. James Alec Garang says its implementation is key to development in the country. The 2016-2017 fiscal budget presented to Parliament by the Finance and Economic Planning Minister yesterday allocates more than 11 billion South Sudanese pounds to the security sector. The minister says he's well aware of the economic challenges facing the country. Unlike previous budgets, this year's draft was presented 3 months into the new fiscal year. Minister Diu says he allocated 5 billion South Sudanese pounds to cover costs of implementing the 2015 peace agreement. He says he believes South Sudan's economy will not recover unless lasting peace is restored across the country. Garang, a senior economist at the Juba-based Ebony Center for Strategic Studies, says the international community pressured South Sudan's government to come up with a budget that not only supports the peace deal but promotes economic reforms. He says the minister got that message. President Salva Kiir formed a humanitarian aid committee last week to work with aid agencies trying to reach people who need food, water, and health care across the country. International and aid agencies and the UN mission in South Sudan say security operatives have erected too many roadblocks that hinder access to needy South Sudanese. The new committee is supposed to remove all obstacles affecting operations of aid agencies, which have been blocked from delivering much-needed assistance to millions of people affected by the conflict. Presidential spokesman Atene Wekiteni says the committee includes government ministers, United Nations officials, and military authorities. And finally, the head of the Joint Monitoring and Evaluation Commission is condemning continued fighting between government and SPLA-IO forces, as well as Riek Machar's recent call for renewed armed resistance. Festus Mohai condemned fighting in Yei, Lir, Jazeera, and Nasir, adding that any further violence is proof of the country's failed leadership. Mohai says he's particularly concerned about what is happening in the Equatoria area, where armed groups are targeting civilians. Mohai says the recent violence has destroyed all the transitional security arrangement mechanisms, such as the Joint Military Ceasefire Commission. He says what little that had been accomplished has been lost, and he called on both sides to regain control of their forces. And that's a look at some of today's top stories. I'm Carol Van Damme.
That's our show for this Wednesday. We now leave you with this new song, Khayina Stakal Sawa, by Lomerica Sun. We have been listening to Lemarika Sun with the new song, Kalina Shtakal. I'm John Tanza in Washington. We are glad to have you with us tonight. Join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.